I want to thank Mark because he has helped me to get all of this stuff together, the PowerPoints, and make it easy for me. It's a different system. I like the system. It just takes a little while to get used to, and I certainly appreciate him and his evangelistic work. It's been nice to meet you. There's 3 points I tried to make last night when we talked about the similarities in organisms. And I laid out the basic way that I go through this material. But I think one of the biggest things for you to take away from this presentation is that there isn't just one theory of evolution. All right, now nobody else is going to make the distinctions unless we make those distinctions. But you know, it's one thing to talk about change and variation and perhaps some new species coming into existence through natural selection, and you'll see tonight that I actually believe Darwin was right on that part of it. It's something else to say that all the major groups have come into existence that way. That, you know, a single cell became, well, hi honey, my daughter's here. Oh, Scott is too. So how did I miss you? Hi, Ty. Ty and Kate, where's Kate? No? My granddaughter stiffed me here. Oh, she's upstairs, okay. Well, anyway, I'm sorry. I'm just a granddad. It's one thing to say that you mix and match some genes and you come up with new characteristics and perhaps come up with a new species. It's another thing to say that everything started from non-life, became a single living cell, single cells became multicellular, multicellular became fish, fish became amphibians, amphibians became reptiles, and then reptiles gave rise to birds and mammals and insects and all of that kind of stuff. That more general theory of evolution is different, and I really believe that about 15% of all biologists probably have questions with the more general theory of evolution. Not natural selection, but the more general theory. And with the problem of how you get life from non-life. All right, so you need to learn to be making distinctions. And people will ask me sometimes, you know, what can I do to help? Well, don't ever use the word evolution again unless you modify it with either general, special, or chemical or something like that. Make sure you know which concept you're dealing with, because you're going to deal with them very differently. Secondly, and what I started with last night with the similarities in organisms, I tried to point out that the real debate here is not over the evidence itself, but how we interpret that evidence. You know, if you look at the similarity in organisms, and there's incredible similarity, which we'll see again tomorrow night when we deal specifically with the so-called intermediate fossils and apes and men and so on. There's a great deal of similarity. You know, if you stand an ape up here, you're going to see a lot of similarities. Hopefully I will be better dressed. But there are a lot of similarities between me and an ape or an orangutan. And we have to explain those similarities. How you explain it is a theory. Evidence doesn't support a theory. You come up with a theory to explain it. And so we have natural theories, and we have those that will allow or include God. You know, supernatural concepts. And so that's a second thing that you need to understand, that the real debate actually is not over the evidence, but how we select it, arrange it, interpret it. And we talked about that last night and gave an example from similarities of organisms. The last one on here really has to do with chemical evolution and the fact that nobody was present at the creation, no matter how old we are and no matter what we know about our families and how much genealogical work we've done on our families. Nobody was there to witness this. No scientist was there. No religious person was there. Nobody who is a theistic evolution. Nobody was there to actually see this happen. We do not see this happen any place today. All right, you cannot do it in a laboratory. So it is beyond the realm of scientific testing. So in essence, it's really not a part of science, it is a part of faith. And whatever you believe about it is going to be accepted or rejected on your faith and how you interpret the evidence. Those are 3 very important points that I will continue to hammer home every chance that I get. So when my professor came in with his evidences for evolution, I finally went back to him and I said, the evidence for creation is exactly the same as your evidence for evolution. We're just dealing with a different interpretation. So last night I dealt with comparative anatomy and morphology. I'm not doing vestigial organs, and I'll tell you why I'm not doing that. That idea that somehow there are things left over in our body from our ancestors, but are now, you know, have no function in us, that argument is just gone. The argument itself is a vestige at this point. Because for the 200 vestigial organs that were marked in men, in humans, by Wiedersheim, some time ago, we have found functions for all of them. There are no vestigial organs in humans, and the argument is gone. So you still find it in the textbooks, which tells me the textbooks are pretty far behind here. You know, so I don't deal with that, but tonight I'm going to deal with genetics, and I want to look at the evidence for genetics, and remember how I've decided to do this. It's been my, I guess my trademark way of presenting this is to give evidence without any interpretation at all and then give you the general evolutionist's best explanation of it, not their weakest explanation. It doesn't do me any good to give you some kind of straw man argument for them. If I can't deal with their best shot, I haven't dealt with it, have I? So let's look at the evidence. Among animals that reproduce sexually, no two, except for identical twins, are exactly alike. The individuals of every species vary in their size, in their proportions, their colorations, internal and external structure, down to their physiology, and even their behavior. Okay? The genetics of every individual in this room, unless you have an identical twin, the genetics of every individual in this room is different. And no matter how much you may resemble your family, no two people in your family are exactly alike. Now, is that not a fact? We recognize that as a fact. Now, when it comes to changes, we start talking about mutations. You can change the genetics of an organism in a number of different ways. You can just recombine the genetics of a mother and father, and you get a child, and it's definitely a child that resembles or reminds you of the father of the mother, but it's a different child. It's not identical. It's not a clone of either parent. Changes in the genetic constitution of an organism may be due to just recombining new genes to produce an offspring. You may have chromosomal mutations, and you may have gene mutations, and this will become important later in the talk. I'm going to go back to the strongest evolutionary interpretation. I read this particular quote from Goldschmidt last night, but I skipped over this one from Hermann J. Mueller, who was a Nobel Prize-winning geneticist. All right, and this was his statement. There are no hypotheses alternative to the principle of evolution. Now, notice there's no modifier on the word evolution, right? It doesn't say special, general, or chemical. But if you read the whole quote, I think you'll be able to figure out that this is referring to chemical and general evolution. There are no hypotheses alternative to the principle of evolution with its tree of life that any competent biologist of today takes seriously. Moreover, the principle is so important for an understanding of the world we live in and of ourselves that the public in general, including students taking biology in high school, should be made aware of. And of the fact that it is firmly established, even as the rotundity, the roundness of the earth is firmly established. Now, I hear people make these statements to their classes all the time. I have students who will tell me that they have had very blunt, dogmatic statements like this made in their classes. And essentially, you see a number of issues here, one of which is, what happens if you're a biologist and you stand up and question it? Then your competency is called into question, right? So people now, even though many people agree with my particular position, if they're just starting out in their biological career, they just dare not speak up. They just dare not speak up. Because once you are marked as either a creationist or an intelligent design proponent, people will begin to treat you differently. Sort of like a leper. I mean, they really do. I'm not making a joke about that. It's like you are unclean, unclean. They're going to give you a bell to ring as you walk through the department. You know, you're just not a real scientist unless you believe this, and that's how strong it is now. Well, he was a wonderful geneticist. He really was. He discovered so many things. But what they're really suggesting is that these finches that Darlene, you weren't with him, were you, hon? these finches that Darwin found on the Galapagos Island are pretty much the explanation for all of this. All right, this concept of natural selection is going to be the underlying mechanism by which all of this takes place. And what we know is there was a common ancestor for the finches that got out into this series of volcanic islands. That's called an archipelago. But out in this series of islands off the coast of South America, northern South America, and we do know that original set of finches appears to have evolved through special evolution or natural selection and changed into 13 different species of finches now. And that is something, how many students have actually seen this in one of their textbooks? I mean, it's just there. One of the other examples that you find of special evolution is this thing on the peppered moths. You may not be able to see it in the top picture, but there's actually a moth there. What do you call it, kids, when a moth blends into its background like that? Do you remember the name? Let the kids answer this one. Camouflage or protective coloration. Paying attention here. How old are you? Almost nine. Shame you guys. Thank you very much. Camouflage or protective coloration, and you really can't see it. In the bottom frame, you see a dark-colored moth against a dark tree. But in the middle, you see that peppered moth up against a dark tree. Around Manchester, England, in the Industrial Revolution, the trees looked pretty much like the moth and the tree in the top picture. The trees were all covered with lichens. And these moths blended into the pattern of those lichens on the tree. And what would be the advantage for that, guys? What's the advantage for a moth that can do that? It's for protection. In other words, predators can't see the peppered moth against the lichens on the tree. So as you might expect, about 95% of the population was peppered. Although there were some dark ones, as in the bottom picture, but only about 5% was this dark form. And why would that be? They stood out like a sore moth, right? I mean, just pretty much, they stood out against those lichen-covered trees, so you wouldn't expect them to be in high abundance. Well, what happened during the Industrial Revolution is the soot from the industry. We used to think that all that soot meant wealth and progress, and we didn't know it was so bad for us. So artists would actually, on postcards of pictures of cities, they'd actually draw in extra smokestacks with all this black smoke pouring out to show people how progressive their city was. Well, that happened in Manchester, and two things happened. Number one, the soot actually killed the lichen, and then it kind of coated the tree black. So now, who has the selective advantage? The dark form. You can see this very clearly, right? And what we found is that the dark form went to being 95% of the population, and the peppered form was much more rare. That makes perfect sense, doesn't it? And basically what an evolutionist or Darwin himself would have argued if he'd known this example was that if you just let that go on for a while, you may actually eliminate one of the forms so that you actually go from peppered moths to the dark form. We have not yet done that. Some people dwell on that, but I'm going to take the argument, you know, for what it's worth. I'm going to give it the strongest statement that I possibly can. I can see the reasoning behind this kind of selection. I have no problem with it. And I'll give you a better example later. But we even saw last night that the wild mustard, you know, was changed into, you know, these incredibly, wonderfully edible things called broccoli, cauliflower, cabbage, Brussels sprouts, kale, and kohlrabi. I can't look at that for too long. When you start looking at what is offered in the textbooks for horse evolution, you start out with something they call the dawn horse. They used to call it Eohippus. They call it Hydrocotherium now. But Eohippus meant dawn horse. The idea was that you had a little tiny thing that was about small. And it had five toes, but it was a horse. And then over time, it evolved through natural selection into these large things that we call horses now that only have one toe and are much, much larger. Okay? And so they'll put these things in. And, you know, I'm willing to grant this argument. Some people won't, but I'm willing to grant the argument that this actually happened. But what have you actually shown in this case? You've shown that you can mix and match genes and you can make them bigger or smaller. We do it with dogs all the time in artificial selection. You can change their proportions. You may even change the number of toes. I don't see anything in that that's much different from artificial selection. And we all understand artificial selection, you know, because we've done it with these dogs. We've done it with the dogs, and we have created some of the most amazing breeds of dogs through artificial selection. And what you're really doing is you're just selecting for certain characters that you want to emphasize, and you're trying to breed for something that looks like that. And so we've changed this wolf stock into some of the most amazing things. I saw a dog the other day. The dog was a pretty good-sized dog, but it had enough skin on it for 12 dogs. I mean, it just had fold after fold after fold of skin. I don't know why we do that kind of stuff. You know, we have been able to breed one so that we now have a very irritating barking rat that we call a chihuahua. You know, I mean, we just like to do that kind of stuff. We've changed dogs and cats and all these agricultural plants and so on. But the question is, you know, just mixing and matching things that are already there does not explain how you get some new or novel character. How you get from a reptile to a bird. There's a lot of changes that have to take place there. I'll deal with that later. We've done the same thing for cattle. And so we have a lot of different kinds of cattle. And, you know, in Kentucky, most of us know actually the breeds. And I don't. I know about four. But I want to tell you an interesting thing that some Russians did really quite some time ago. I'm going to cough with the microphone off, I hope. Oh, coughed right into that one. There was an extinct muck ox that you see in the top picture here that had been extinct for at least 300 years. Just didn't exist anymore. It was gone from the face of the earth. And so the Russian geneticists decided to take modern breeds of cattle and kind of artificially select in a reverse direction. And that's what they came up with at the bottom, which I think they did a pretty good job of kind of doing this reverse natural selection. Do you have any problems with these at this point? Most of you don't, do you? Because you know that we do this all the time. What do you think the title of that article was? Think for a minute. If you were just doing the title to the article in the newspaper. Evolution in reverse. You can just see it, can't you? Now, is this special, general, or chemical? Special. Plain old recombination of stuff. You do the same thing every time you get ready to get dressed to go out. You go to your closet. You have all of these different shirts, blouses, slacks, you know, all the different things that you have as clothing articles, sweaters, coats, you know, and you mix and match to create new combinations that are unique. It's harder for girls than it is for guys. Okay? They really have a hard life because of that. But anyway, I heard the amen out of that. All right, so we just mix and match these things and we keep coming up with new combinations. But at some point, if you want something really new, you've got to get something else to get in that closet, right? To use. And that's the idea of general evolution. And I just want you to understand that we're not sure this mechanism can possibly do that, and I'll show you that as we go along. Now, I've talked about the finches. I'm going to skip over that and Darwin, because Darwin was not the issue. I know there are a lot of brethren who feel that way, that Darwin and his ideas were really awful. But Darwin basically noticed that artificial selection could go on in nature. That's really what he noticed. And then he made some postulations off that. But it's not really, the issue is really not that. All right? He then went on later to come up with this kind of more general concept that perhaps men and apes had come from a common ancestor and that you could apply his mechanism. But he still really never pushed that. It was friends of his like Thomas Huxley who kind of became his bulldog and went around and started pushing that idea. But it wasn't so much Darwin, and I'm going to show you why in a minute. Now, we actually dealt with this last night, so I don't want to deal with this again. But the actual idea that species are immutable did not come from a creationist as you would normally think of it. But religious people at that time had a particular religious belief that they said was taught by the Bible. And that is that species couldn't change. And the argument was a fairly simple theological argument. It basically said if God is all-powerful, whatever He creates is perfect, therefore it would never need to change. Make sense to you? Perfectly rational theological argument. It isn't what the Bible says, but it was a good theological argument, and everybody believed it, including Carol Linné, who was the father of modern taxonomy. Not only was he a creationist and a Bible believer, but he was a scientist who started the entire field of systematics, which is where I work. And he was the one who said that species could not be mutated. They could not be changed. You could not ever change it. And it was a theological argument. It was his theological belief that that's what the Bible taught. Well, I want to show you that that's not true. If you look, you find that the Bible never talks about species. It always talks about the kind. And most of us are familiar with that. In fact, even my atheist friends talk about mankind. And they use a very biblical term to refer to mankind as a species. But that's part of the problem. Linnaeus looked at mankind and he knew that all of these humans were capable of reproducing and having offspring. And he saw mankind as a species. And he said, you know, that's it. You know, species are immutable. And it is true with reference to man, even in the Bible. Because if you look at let me go to this next one. This is just a listing of all of the references to the kind. But if you go to Genesis 1:27, it clearly implies that mankind was a unique creation of God. Would you not agree? Absolutely unique from the beast of the field and so on. So mankind was a species, and because of this thinking, he laid this law down, and all scientists and religious people of his day believed that you could not change a species. You could not get new species, for instance. But if you look at Genesis 25, you'll find that cattle are referred to as a kind, all right, and that God caused them to reproduce after their own kind. But the word cattle in the Hebrew not only includes every species of cow, but it also includes sheep and goats, other things that graze on the hillsides. So let's just restrict it to cattle. It turns out that there's not just one species of cattle. There's many species of cattle, and they're even grouped into larger groupings that we call genera. So this word, this particular group, could actually have created new species without violating the Bible. This is a very important point. You could come up with a new species of cow and not violate anything about God's kind. And the same thing is true for hawks in Leviticus 11:16. The word hawk refers to not just many species, but many genera and several different families. In our classification system, the hawk is at the superfamily level. So you could come up with many species, and groupings of hawks and not violate God's statement about things reproducing after their own kind. So this is a biblical warning to you. Sometimes we take our own thinking and we impose it on what the Bible says, and we start using language that the Bible never uses. You start talking about species being immutable because of God's kinds. You just step beyond what the Bible actually says. The Bible says the kinds are immutable. All right, God created every kind to reproduce after its own kind. But you could get new species. That's not a violation of what the Bible says. So let's look at this for a second. I want to point this out because I'm not ashamed of what the Bible says. In the same book that talks about the creative acts of God and the Genesis flood, it gives us the story of Jacob and Laban and their relationship and how Jacob was trying to get the wife that he really loved. Okay? And he went into servitude, right, to Laban. And Laban kept changing his wages. And every time he changed his wages, what happened? What was the wage? It had to do with the number of spotted, speckled, striped cattle, all that kind of stuff. And what happened every time Laban changed the wage, what happened to Jacob's flocks? They all changed too, and they multiplied. So Laban would go and he would change the rules, and then what happened? Jacob's flocks would change and they would multiply, and he did it how many times? Wasn't it 10 times that he changed? It seems like it was almost 10 times that he changed it. Well, I want to tell you, the Old Testament writers had a rather sophisticated understanding of this idea of artificial selection or natural selection. And I get that from this particular chapter. If you go to chapters 30 and 31. Now here's the important point. If Jacob had not understood artificial selection, he would not have known what he should get. Did you hear that? If he had not understood artificial selection, he simply would not have recognized the miracle. He wouldn't have known that God was performing a miracle. He had some understanding of what he should have gotten when he bred those cattle, did he not? And it just kept changing, and he kept multiplying, and he recognized that as a miracle from God. He had a very sophisticated understanding of artificial selection, or that could not have happened. I've never read that anyplace. It's just something I noticed one day. There's just no way that he would have even known a miracle was going on if he didn't know what he should have gotten. You got that point? Because I got to move on. Study that one if you have a problem with it. So here's the way I look at it. Basically, what I think God did is he created mankind and ape kind and cow kind and horse kind and bird kind. And since the creation, they have changed through natural selection and perhaps new species have come into existence. All right. If you are, which means I'm actually saying I believe the special theory, but I believe in a supernatural creation. Now, if I were a theistic evolutionist or a general evolutionist, I would have to shift to the general theory of evolution. The idea that this mechanism will explain everything from an amoeba to single cell to multicellular to fish, amphibians, reptiles, birds, mammals. All right? But you don't have to accept that just accepting the special theory. And I believe that what I've drawn at the top major groups created abruptly by God and changing through natural selection or special evolution to create new species, it explains everything that we see. My theory explains everything that we see. You do not have to postulate a common original source, a root to this whole thing, you know? So, part of the problem in this is that people don't understand what evolutionists actually mean by evolution. They have some real basic misconceptions, one of which is this kind of thing that Gary Larson just made famous, okay, in his cartoons. The idea that somehow, you know, this fish decides to just hold his breath and see if he can run across that rock. That somehow an individual organism can actually evolve. Individual organisms cannot evolve. If we were going to have a race to see who got dinner, I would be left behind. And if the winners were the only ones who got to survive, I would die. All right? That's the way it would work. All right? I can't change my speed. I can't change my genetics. My genetics are simply what they are. So an individual organism cannot change. Sometimes we say, well, you know, we sort of adapt or evolve to new environmental conditions. It's a really poor choice of words. What we actually do is we acclimate. If I send you to Alaska and I set you there for a while, you know, when you come back here, the cold weather we had yesterday is going to seem pretty warm to you. You see what I mean? You'll acclimate, but that's not adaptation. There's a difference between those two words. Well, another example that Gary Larson gave was the idea of the cheetah and the gazelles. You know, he's putting on some Nikes or something. Doesn't have Nike on it. Apparently they didn't give him permission. But it's like if I put these new tennis shoes on, I can change my abilities and I can catch those things better. You see what I mean? Well, it doesn't work that way. What has to happen is what we saw with those peppered moths. It has to be a change within the population itself. All right? The ones that have the genetics to be able to, you know, that already have the genetics, them the black color, those were the ones that once the soot was on the tree, they survived. But they didn't evolve that because the trees got dark. They already had it. You see that? You have to have the characteristics. And then the environment has to change. It's the only way natural selection can actually work. So natural selection never works with individuals. It works with populations, and somebody in that population has to already have that characteristic. And that is one of the major misconceptions, okay? Only populations can change over time. Now, this is Darwin's concept of natural selection, and I want to show you that you actually believe this. It turns out that if you put some new organisms in a place where there's nobody there in that particular niche, nobody filling that job function, they will just start to increase, and they will just start increasing, and they'll 2 will become 4, 8, 16, 32, 64, 1, you know, it just happens like that. It's called an exponential growth curve. All right? And Darwin noticed that. Over time, it will just take off exponentially. If you have one pregnant female cockroach who produces 50 new female cockroaches, and each of them produces 50 new female cockroaches, in 7 months, you will have 8 billion cockroaches in your house, according to this curve. His second point was that when you actually look at populations, they tend to remain remarkably constant. If I start talking about the number of gray squirrels in Jefferson County, if you don't change their habitat, the number remains remarkably constant, something which is apparently not true for robins. Sorry, that's sort of an in-joke from yesterday's lunch. So here's Darwin's concept. If this is what could be, you know, oh, there's a graph for this. What happens is they start off like gangbusters, but then as food runs out or space runs out, they begin to level off, and then they just stay at that carrying capacity. So This is where Darwin was so brilliant. As far as I'm concerned, he was one of the most brilliant scientists of his day, particularly as an observational scientist. He did what I call lateral thinking. He said, if this is how many you could have, and it could just skyrocket, but you only have this many, somebody's dying off. There's some kind of competition for the things they need to live. Does that make sense to you? Some kind of competition for the things they need to live. And so he postulated that they were struggling for survival and competing against one another in that population for food and resources and places to live and so on. I mean, the reason all these skunks are being killed on the road right now is that the parents have thrown them out of the house and they have to find their own territory. And it's not as easy, and they got to cross a lot of roads to do that. Now, what possums are doing, I don't have a clue. I don't dodge them anymore. Okay, so those genetics are gone from the population. A struggle for survival results, and then this is what I think was so brilliant about him. He went back to his artificial selection stuff, and he said, you know, all of these individuals in the population, they're all different genetically. So the ones that have the best combinations of genetics, they're the ones who are going to get the food and survive to pass those genes on. Did that all make sense to you? And so he went on, and so you have these curves, and look at 4 and 5. He went, variations exist among the members of a population, and the ones with the most favorable variations will actually survive to produce offspring. So you will change your population from individuals who already had those traits. Did that all make sense to you? There are a lot of variations in the human population. You may not know this, but we now recognize at least 211 different human cultures, populations, races, however you want to describe it. 211, and yet we're all one flesh, right? All capable of reproducing. Well, here's what he did. He did it with giraffes, and he went to the long neck of the giraffe, and he said, here's how it works. Giraffes went through dry periods and wet periods on the Serengeti Plains, and when food got scarce, the current thinking in Darwin's day was that they just kept stretching and stretching, and so the next generation's necks were longer. But Darwin went at it a different way, and he said, no, you have short-necked, intermediate, and long-necked giraffes, and when it gets dry and food gets scarce, since they eat only out of trees, the ones with the longest necks, the genes for the longest necks, they're the ones who will survive. So the next generation will have longer necks genetically. Do you see the difference there? No. All right. Now, I'm telling you, there are people who will pick at that because, you know, mother giraffes do not feed their babies. So it makes you wonder how the babies survived, right? But I'm not going to quibble with it. I'm just going to accept the argument exactly the way it is. It still doesn't bother me. Changing giraffes doesn't bother me. I want to know how you got from the reptile to the giraffe. That general evolution thing is much more important to me. And there are other concepts on the giraffe. We're not quite sure. Now, we see natural selection in action every time we use an insecticide in the house to kill cockroaches. You know, if you don't kill them all, the ones who can actually tolerate the insecticide are the only ones that are going to live, and the next generation will be more resistant. That's natural selection. We do it. That's what we're worried about right now with antibiotics, isn't it? If we keep doing the antibiotics, the only things that are going to be left are the ones that are resistant to all of our antibiotics. That's natural selection. Do you have a problem with that, or do you see that the Bible actually allows that to happen? Okay, cool. That's a special theory. I've read that before, and I'm not going to read it again. Same thing is true with the finches. I have no problem with that. You know, the Bible allows that. We went through the theory. We went through this. Now, then somebody says, yeah, but you're not giving them the whole story, David. You're not talking enough about mutation, and I need to get to mutation. But in a NOVA program called Did Darwin Get It Wrong? And I'm saying he got it right. The narrator was talking to Norman Macbeth about it, and this is what he said. Can you fault evolutionist logic? Now, wouldn't it be nice to know that they're talking about general evolution? How hard is it to put that word in there? They never put it in. You're going to have to put it in yourself. Not so much their logic, that really isn't too bad. What I do is I work more on the way that they handle their evidence. Oh, that sounds familiar, doesn't it? For instance, there's the practice called extrapolation. Okay? Observing the animals, the breeders, for a few years, 20 years roughly, Darwin saw they were making a lot of improvements in various organisms like sheep and dogs, pigeons and aspidistras. What he did is he took the 20 years of experience and he said, if you just give nature several hundred million years, there is no limit to what nature can do. So what he said is, my natural selection, my speciation, given enough time, I can explain it all. Now, he didn't prove that. He just postulated it on the basis of 20 years of experience with artificial selection. And here's what Macbeth says. That didn't work out in practice. It's an unjustified procedure. They discover, meaning the geneticists, that when you actually look at the results, that after a certain time, if you breed animals very, very carefully, they either become sterile or they snap back to their original form. Something that we've seen as we have bred thoroughbreds, as we have bred dogs. You know, these things we create, they can't compete in the wild. They either get out-competed in the wild by the wild type, or they die out, or they become sterile, or they do interbreed and they just end up back at the natural thing. So you don't have you have a limit to the amount of change that you can get just through recombining. And he says, well, what's the biggest problem? And he says, the most important problem with general evolutionists in my mind is their failure to make a dent in the problem of general evolution, which he referred to as macroevolution. Micro, little changes in a beak or a feather, slight improvements in rows of feathers, for instance, isn't any great problem. It isn't even a very important problem. It's the big changes, like from a little tree shrew, so big, up to a whale, or from a reptile to a mammal. Those are the really important things. And then he went on to say, they have no clue. And he went around to various evolutionary symposia. He's a Harvard-trained lawyer, and he challenged them with the way they were using their evidence. And they had to admit that they were abusing their evidence to say that you could get the big changes. It doesn't support it. You really can't develop that theory. So the issue is not whether you can change the frequency of genes by mixing and matching them in a pool of a population. The real issue is whether you can get limited versus unlimited change. And my argument is that the evidence that we have today suggests change within very clear limits. You can't use this as a mechanism to get from a reptile to a bird or a mammal. And that's what all of my geneticist friends are saying too, particularly the ones that work in artificial selection. The key issue is this limited versus unlimited genetic change. So let me give you an example. This came from a debate that a friend of mine, a person that I respect highly, I disagree with him, but his name is Frank Lovell, and many of you may have gone to the debate that he had with Buddy Payne. But Frank said, today we know that mutations can alter species in every imaginable way. Science has not discovered any law of nature that places a limit on the altering effects of mutations. No limit has been discovered. So this is the real issue now. Not natural selection. I agree with that. But whether you can continue that, no matter how much time you have, to get to those big changes for general evolution. And that's basically what you would have to go to one of these geologic things. That theory that everything arose from that original source and so on. We've talked about that already. So if you look at the bottom tree down here, that is the general evolutionist tree, based on their faith, and it is their faith, okay, the substance of things hoped for, the evidence of things not seen, it is based on their faith that given enough time, you can get the big changes using this mechanism. All right? Well, that's why I think you have got to make this distinction between general and special theory. It's one thing to have things change within apes or man or cow. It's another thing to have them go from one major group to another, to another, to another. Now, let's go to the unlimited change. That's the most important thing I need to talk about. And let's talk about something that we all know, and that's the Teenage Mutant Ninja Turtles. How did they get that way? They mutated, and what was it, guys? What was it? It was ooze in the sewer. Thank you, bud. How old are you?
Eight.
They know what I'm talking about, guys. You don't think they know what I'm talking about, but they know what I'm talking about. So they had some kind of radioactive ooze, and a lot of our science fiction is built on this. All right, the idea is that with radioactivity or mutation like this, you can get the unlimited change, and then we've come up with all sorts of creatures. All you have to do is look at the first Star Wars, look at the cantina scene, and you know where our imagination has gone with this, right? You know? The only one I really didn't like evolutionarily was Jar Jar Binks. I don't think I was alone on that. But anyway, if mutation, radioactive mutation, could actually help an organism, then I'm not sure why we're bothered about dumping radioactive waste in the ocean. Because we might just come up with Teenage Mutant Ninja Sea Turtles that will come and save us from all of our problems. But think about science fiction. Isn't the Hulk another example of that in science fiction? Great science fiction, just poor science. Wasn't David Banner in his lab and he got zapped with the radioactivity when that thing blew up? And nice guy, you just don't want to make him mad, kind of thing. Well, that's really good science fiction, but it is not good science. The truth is that people die from radiation. And when we were making the two bombs, the one that was dropped on Hiroshima and one on Nagasaki, they were called Fat Man and Little Boy, I think were the two names we actually had for those. There was an accident in the lab, and the people in the lab got zapped with too much radiation, and they did not turn into the Hulk. They all died. And so doctors and dentists are very careful to walk behind leaded walls, you know, and wear dosimeters to make sure that they don't get too much radiation. You know, most of us are worried about where we live. But this idea of mutation has really caught on. And in Lexington, Thomas Hunt Morgan started working with Frick to show what you could do with mutation. And that's the science building is named after him. He finally went to California, though, to continue his research. But these were the things that he did. This is a normal pair of fruit flies. You may never have wanted to look that close. All right. And if you cross them, you can get various normal changes. But what Thomas Hunt Morgan did is he started zapping them with radiation and putting them and trying to almost freeze them to death or heat them or chemically alter them. And he came up with a lot of different mutations. He killed some of them off. There were lethal conditions. He changed their wings, their eyes, all sorts of changes. The top row, the normal fly eye is on the upper left, and they have been able to remove the eye, and they've been able to change the eye shape in all these different ways. The wings are the next two rows. They've been able to change it from the normal wing at number one. They've taken the wings off. They've gotten four wings, which is not on this particular chart. Immediately, they postulated that flies came from a four-winged ancestor. Even though that fly can't walk. It can't walk, much less fly. Four wings is just too much. Okay? This is the family portrait at Christmas. Because I used them, I told them I would put in the family picture. We have changed these flies, but what have we done? Have we ever gotten something uniquely different from these flies? No. And you can do it as a science fair experiment in the 6th or 7th grade, kids. You just put them in these bottles in your refrigerator at home and feed them, and you can do the mutations there. Generally speaking, mutation is simply bad for us, and we recognize that. So I don't see this as being the answer to the problem. You know, and I'll tell you, sometimes religious people, when they can't answer a question, will invoke a miracle. But in science, when we can't answer it, we invoke a mutation. You just need to understand that. Well, we know that playing around with chemicals in the lab is not good, and being by nuclear test areas is not good. And I just want to ask you a question here. This is one of those Italian Formula One cars. Well, it has an English term on it, so maybe it's not. But I was actually in Budapest when I saw this this postcard, and I thought this is a great example. You know how much time we spend tuning up those Formula One cars, you know, for various races. All of the NASCAR stuff, man, they spend hours and hours and hours and days and months just fine-tuning it. Well, let me just ask you a question. Let's just pretend like we're going to mutate it the way radioactive stuff mutates us. We'll just take a .30-06 and shoot it through the engine block. What do you think the chances are that its performance will be better? You just consider it to be not likely. In fact, you really consider it to be impossible. I don't know why scientists have so tied themselves to this concept of mutation by cosmic radiation and stuff, because it's just like shooting a .30-06 through this engine block. It's not going to make it better, and we know it's not going to make it better. And the truth is, a lot of our aging comes from all of that background radiation that's zapping us right now, that cosmic radiation. And you say, not in this building. We're at church. No, it really is coming through the ceiling of this building, and it's going right through you. Gamma rays are shooting right through you. And if you want to know how many times that happens, if you look at a TV screen that has snow on it, 1 out of 100 dots is cosmic radiation that just hit the screen. So you're subjected to it your entire life, aren't you? It's partially what we think causes aging. Well, we might like to compromise. Personally, I wish they'd teach creation along with evolution. I never did believe in the literal interpretation of Darwin. But I want to finish this with a biblical thing that I borrowed from a fellow by the name of Josh McDowell. His book, Evidence That Demands a Verdict. I am disturbed by the religious stuff that he put at the end in terms of how you become a child of God. But the rest of the book I certainly can recommend to people. It's been a big help to me. It deals with external evidences. And what he has said is that when you look at Jesus, there are only certain alternative views that you can have. You either believe that his claims to be the Lord were true, or you believe that they were false. And if you believe that they were false, the only two alternatives was that he knew that his claims were false, or he didn't know that his claims were false. If he didn't know his claims were false, then he was either a sincerely deluded Hebrew, or he was a lunatic, because he was willing to die for that belief. If he knew his claims were false, then he was deliberately misrepresenting himself. So that makes him a liar and a hypocrite, a demon and a fool. Now, if his claims were true, then Jesus is Lord. And the only alternatives that you have tonight or any time is that you can either accept him as that Lord or reject him. I thought that was pretty simple. I tell you, I got a card from somebody once, and this is how I will close. There are a lot of people in history who have made the claim to be gods. History is crowded with men who would be gods. And we have read their history many times. But there is only one God who was willing to be man. That is our Lord and Savior, Jesus Christ. And I'm going to stop with thank you. I appreciate your attention, and I will leave it to you to tell them what we're doing.